Welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Monday, February 27th, 2017. I'm your host, Scott Burton. On today's show, Fred Thorstensen and Annette Smith will tell us about plans to construct a memorial for the Princess Sophia. Steve Kosis will be here to highlight the Monday night planetarium presentation on the Aurora. Musician Annie Bartholomew will preview her first Friday concert at Kindred Post. And we'll get an update from the statewide writing group 49 Writers with Katie Bosler. Those interviews, National Native News, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more right here, live and local on a Juno afternoon, currently 36 degrees at the Juno International Airport.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A Native American high school student in Kansas recently raised concerns about a mascot when her basketball team played a team with the name Indians. As Rhonda Lavaldo reports, a school banner with the Indians logo was taken down, but school officials say they have permission to use the mascot.
Lawrence High School's Madison McKinney was playing in a basketball game against the Shawnee Mission North Indians when their fans began to do things she did not like. So she grabbed her phone to get video.
We experienced seeing them have two mascots. One was a male wearing a headdress, and one was a female wearing a buckskin dress. And before the boys' game, the student section was doing the tomahawk chop. And just like their usual, they call their school values tribal tenants. And it's just very upsetting to see stuff like that.
Since the incident, the Native American group at Lawrence High asked their administration and had the banner with the Indians logo taken down. However, Shawnee Mission North's communication director, Aaron Little, says their use is okay because they were given permission by the Eastern Shawnee Tribe of Oklahoma.
We are proud of our heritage and that the school mascots are a symbol of strength and admiration, and they're really a reflection upon our school, and that the district was named after the Shawnee Nation Tribe. And in 1992, the Shawnee Mission School District communicated directly with the Eastern Shawnee Tribe of Oklahoma, and we received written correspondence with them that the tribe was proud to lend its name and support to the education of America's youth.
Since the incident, the chief of the Eastern Shawnee Tribe, Glenna Wallace, spoke to the Shawnee Mission Post, stating that the use of the tomahawk chop should not be overlooked or condoned, and that the image is of a plains tribe, not a woodlands tribe, which is what the Shawnee are. Wallace also stated their business council will be looking to add an item to their agenda at their next meeting to rescind permission given. This is Rhonda Lavaldo for National Native News.
The United Nations Special Rapporteur is visiting the United States, gathering information on how energy development is impacting indigenous people. Victoria Tolley-Corpuz spent the day in Albuquerque, New Mexico, Saturday, meeting with tribes and Native groups. Among attendees at the consultation was Michelle Cook, a SJD candidate at the University of Arizona School of Law.
I think it's a wonderful strategy. I think if you really want to understand what's happening on the ground to Indigenous peoples' human rights, you have to go to ground zero. So with her coming out to Indian country, she's been able to see what extractive industries have done, and she's been able to hear firsthand the human narrative, the personal stories of how those extractive industries has caused great suffering to the people. And I hope that she carries those narratives to the United Nations and throughout the world so that our rights can be respected and so that our nations can live.
Energy projects and their impacts to indigenous people have been heightened due to the battle in North Dakota over the Dakota Access Pipeline. A meeting with the UN official is scheduled this week in Bismarck before her 10-day trip wraps up on Friday. A report with her findings and recommendations is expected to be presented this year before the UN Human Rights Council. The National Indigenous Women's Resource Center and a number of tribes and Native groups are urging a federal court to side with the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe in its legal battle against the Dakota Access Pipeline. The women's group filed its support document in U.S. District Court in Washington, D.C. last week. The Standing Rock Sioux and Cheyenne River Sioux tribes are challenging the federal government's decision to terminate the environmental study and grant an easement for the pipeline to cross a waterway. The women's group is concerned about protecting women and children from violence and sex trafficking, which advocates say often occur in oil production areas. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. Native American Rights Fund has been helping Indian tribes for over 40 years with critical issues such as treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior with your support for NARF's work. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're listening to A Juno Afternoon here on Monday, February 27th, 2017. Scott Burton, your host today on this beautiful Monday afternoon. And now joining me in the studio is Fred Thorstensen and Annette Smith. They're both members of Pioneers of Alaska, who is behind an idea to construct a memorial for the Princess Sophia. Fred and Annette, welcome to the show, both of you.
Thank you, Scott.
Yeah, it's nice to have you here. Fred or Annette, to get people up to speed on the Princess Sophia, if they don't know the history of this tragedy, will one of you tell us about that?
Okay, the Princess Sophia was the last steamer to leave Skagway in 1918, heading south. So she was taking the last of the people from the gold rush.
Like the end of October, right?
October 23rd, she left Skagway.
Okay.
So she was going to be taking these folks south. And on the early morning on the 24th, she struck Vanderbilt Reef. And there was a pretty vicious storm, snow, wind, you know, typical October weather for Juneau. So several ships actually came and responded, but the weather would not let them lower any of the lifeboats or get people off. And the weather just kept getting worse and worse.
And remind us where Vanderbilt Reef is.
It is in the middle of Lynn Canal. You can actually see it if you're at Sunshine Cove. You can see the reef out past the island
okay,
there.
Thank you.
Yeah. So she hit going south, and then they tried on the 24th, they tried on the 25th to try and get people off, but the weather was so bad that in some cases it drove the ships completely away. So late in the evening on the 25th, as the storm worsened, all the ships that had responded were gone. And when I say ships, they're really, really small compared to what we think of as ships today. And she was left alone on the reef in the storm. And somewhere around 6 o'clock, nobody knows exactly, the storm was so violent that it literally took the ship and threw it over to the other side of the reef. So she is now sunk, facing the opposite direction. She's facing north. And everybody died.
I know you're a diver and have dove mm-hmm. that site. I want to get to that in a minute and ask for some descriptions. Fred, tell us about your involvement in this project and tell us what this memorial might look like.
Okay, sure. The Pioneers of Alaska is an organization that one of its missions is to preserve the history of Alaska. And this is a event that hasn't been properly memorialized. So we're proposing to place a bronze plaque with a bas-relief of the ship on it and a memorial to the passengers and crew members who perished in the wreck. And we're also proposing to place a historical interpretive plaque that tells the story of the wreck and the recovery and response efforts from Juneau that weren't told.
And we were talking a little bit before the show. Estimates of those that passed is somewhere around 350
right.
souls lost. Is that right?
Yes.
Right. So it was a big deal.
It was a big deal. It was huge. And at the time, the Juneau was also experiencing a epidemic of Spanish flu. And so the community had to respond to go out and scour the beaches looking for the remains of the victims, getting them back and preparing them to be shipped back to their homes. So that's one of the projects that we're working on. That our local igloos, Men's Igloo 6 and Women's Igloo 6, are doing that project. And, of course, we're always open to people offering donations for that. We are expecting to spend about $20,000 to accomplish that project. And is it okay if I talk a little bit about the other project that we're doing?
Sure.
Do you want to wait?
No, go for it.
Okay. The other project that we're working on is working with the Maritime Museum of British Columbia and the state of Alaska to develop a traveling exhibit. There's going to be two, a 4,000-square-foot exhibit that contains artifacts, pictures, digital material, and a smaller one that is 2,000 square feet that only will have pictures and digital information. The exhibits will travel from British Columbia up through Southeast Alaska to Skagway, Whitehorse, and Dawson. And it's supposed to be in Juneau, July, August, and September of 2018. And so it's going to be a pretty exciting exhibit. It's going to be told from the perspective of the O'Brien family, which is a family from Dawson, Yukon Territory, that had five children. And it's going to tell the story by community in information pods from this family's perspective of getting on the riverboat in Dawson, coming down the river to Whitehorse, changing to the White Pass Railroad, getting to Skagway, getting on the ship, and then the experience on the reef itself. And Juneau's information is going to be about the recovery and response. And we're working with Juneau Community Foundation on that to accept donations to help with the traveling exhibit to get it throughout Southeast Alaska.
Okay. The first part of the project, the sort of the physical part, you mentioned that's going to be up near Eagle River Recreation Area. Is
yes,
that right?
we're working with the state parks in, get a permit to place it in the Eagle River State Recreation Area, just south of the Vanderbilt Reef Rec Site, and it should be a pretty moving experience for people to go out there and ponder, you know, what happened out there on that October night.
I bet. All right, so that happened in 1918. Annette, what does it look like today?
Well, currently the wreck is, the bow is upright and sits in about 60 feet of water. So you've got the bow upright pointing towards the reef. About midships where the boilers were, the boilers are all exploded out. And then from the boilers to the stern, she's rolled over on her port side as she goes down the reef. It's a beautiful wreck. It, I was telling him about the first experience I had on it, the first time I dove it. The bow area is completely covered in Metridiums, or these giant plumas anemones. So they're white anemones, and they stand when they're fully up, 4 to 5 feet tall, and they have these big, beautiful flower heads that are, a foot and a half to 2 feet across. So the first time I dove on the wreck, we went down on the bow, and the visibility was a little cloudy, so you couldn't see things really clear. So as we swam up the center of the bow, all the railings were covered, and all these anemones were standing up. And they were waving in the current, and you could just see these kind of white ghostly figures. And we swam up the bow, and it was just like seeing all the ghosts of the ship lined up as I swam up there. It was really an incredible experience.
It must have been emotional, too.
It was, because you know what happened. You know there were no survivors. You know they didn't find everybody, and you can still find bones on the wreck. I've taken photos of some of the bones on the wreck, and because 50 horses died in the process also. It's beautiful. There's beautiful creatures that live in the wreck.
I suspect both of you have studied the history around this wreck extensively. Is there a takeaway from what happened there, something that we can learn, something that could have gone differently?
You want to answer that or you want me to?
Well, I could think of a couple of things. Go ahead.
Well, I've looked at it real carefully. I'm also a licensed captain, so I look at the decisions that the captain made. I've read all of the documents, including the court documents of the wreck, and the conclusion from the courts is that the captain acted in a prudent manner. Now, there is a lot of controversy about whether he could have got some people off. And if you look at the photos, might have, at the early part, been able to get some people off, but you would have lost a few lives in the process. It was a very difficult decision, and I think he made the right decision. Unfortunately, it turned out wrong, but for the time and the weather, I think he made the right decision.
And the navigation, and one of the ironies of the whole thing was that at the time there was only an unlighted buoy at the reef, mm-hmm. and one of the rescue ships that came up, the Lighthouse Tender Cedar, had the lighted buoy for the reef on board to be installed, and instead they ended up performing this recovery effort. But you can imagine in the blowing storm with the snow and the waves and everything going on, one of the ways that they had to determine where they were in the channel was to blow the ship's whistle and count the seconds back to determine how far they were, you know, using the echo. And so, you know, the methods were crude. It was unfortunate that's a pretty small reef that they hit, but, you know, it was just an unfortunate event.
Okay, and this memorial and the traveling exhibit all will serve to teach people more about it. If somebody wants to help the Pioneers of Alaska or contribute, how can they do that?
Well, they could to help out with the memorial project at the Eagle River State Park. They could go on the Pioneers of Alaska website. It's pioneersofalaska.org. And look for the Grand Igloo Foundation, which is a 501c3 entity that can accept donations and give you a tax credit. And you can make a donation by earmarking your donation to the Princess Sophia Project. If you'd like to contribute to the traveling exhibit, then that fundraising effort is being done through the Juneau Community Foundation. One thing I forgot to mention is that we're also working with the community of Skagway. There's a ad hoc group there that was appointed by the mayor to help develop the traveling exhibit, and the William Brady or Brady Foundation has already donated $20,000 to help with the traveling exhibit. So they're looking for, I think, a total of $60,000 or something like that to have this thing be successful. It's a large event.
When might the memorial at Eagle Beach go up if this all works out?
We're hoping to do the commemoration on October 25th of 2018 at the site. I think that would be a real powerful way to commemorate that, to actually be out there near the site on the date 100 years later, and remembering the people and the events that happened out there.
All right. Well, thank you both for coming on the show and sharing about this project.
Thanks for having us.
Anytime. Is there anything else that either of you would like to add?
No. Thank you very much for offering us the opportunity to talk to you here today.
Anytime. Thank you.
Trip. The year was 1918. was on an ocean-going ship called Princess Sophia. First we went south by river on a boat named the Washburn, through vast woodlands past the Pink Mountains, slow winding railroad, canyon and waterfall, through the crowded coastal town and down to the harbor. Mother held on to both our hands, the ship loomed up before us, full of the brightest lights you could imagine. But down at the waterline, over the dark side, dark as the longest night of the whole winter, I heard the shouting as we cast off. I heard the order ring out clear, warm in my slumber, and fell to dreaming. Dreamt of an angel there, clear as the sunlight, pure as the falling snow, warm as a fireside. The droning of the engine song, the moaning of the wind outside, hush now, Mary, remember the angels. Sister Mary on the top and I on the bottom. The good ship running through the dark on the tails of autumn.
Peterson and the Amy, the Esther.
I heard the screaming up above. I felt the floor beneath me move. Don't cry, Mary. Remember the angels. Crash on the breaking board. Cold water rising. The crush of my father's arms. Then holding on to
AWARE is delighted to honor four women whose contributions have enhanced the lives of women and children in Juneau. On March 4th at Centennial Hall, AWARE will host their 21st Women of Distinction Gala, honoring Andrea Caesar, Sue Douglas, Chris Sell, and Rena Sims. Doors open at 5:30 with a silent auction, no host bar, and music by Tom Loker. Tickets at AWARE, 586-6623, or online at thejahc.org.
You're listening to A Juneau Afternoon here on Monday, February 27th. Currently a beautiful and sunny 36 degrees here in the capital city. Joining me on the show now, Steve Kosis, volunteer extraordinaire at the Marie Drake Planetarium. And he's here to tell us about tonight's Aurora presentation. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Thank you so much, Scott.
Yeah, nice to have you here. What's the forecast for tonight look like, by the way? I don't know if the clouds come in before.
Well, the University of Alaska Fairbanks has a website in their geophysics department. You just search on Aurora Forecast, and they're forecasting low activity for the aurora tonight. However, Friday in the past, there was a very bright aurora, and it was also bright Saturday. So check that forecast. They can look ahead about 2 or 3 days for the aurora.
Well, the beauty is the forecast for inside the Marie Drake Planetarium is pretty high tonight.
That's true. Rain or shine, we'll be showing the stars in the planetarium with our 50-year-old now Spitz projector made in Pennsylvania.
And if people haven't been to the Marie Drake Planetarium, you're right between Harborview Elementary and JDHS, right?
Yeah, it's by that artificial turf field with the fence around it, right behind it. And we're at 1415 Glacier Avenue.
Okay, and admission is free?
Free, and we try to make the show suitable for all ages.
And it starts at 6:30.
P.M. tonight, that's right.
And it's free, and you'll be presenting what are a few things people can expect?
Well, we're going to first use our Spitz projector to look at what the stars would be here in Juneau if it was clear tonight. And that'll take about half an hour. And we talk about events in the sky. Venus is quite bright in the evening, and you can see Saturn and Mars in the morning. And when that's over, then we'll have a 30-minute presentation on the Northern Lights. This is the spring and fall, September, October, March, and February, the best time to see the Northern Lights, and a good time to see them as soon as it gets dark. But midnight is usually the best time to see them because of the Earth's magnetosphere, where the charged particles that cause them accumulate.
And are you going to talk about that a little bit tonight?
Yeah, there's three ingredients for the aurora. You need the solar wind, specifically a large flare called a coronal mass ejection. And that flare goes out in three dimensions in space. So the flare has to hit the Earth. And the second ingredient is the magnetic field of the Earth that captures the charged particles from the solar wind. And the last ingredient, the third ingredient, like a cookbook, is high atmospheric gases, mostly oxygen and nitrogen, that are excited by the charged particles and then emit light.
Okay, it sounds very interesting. You know, I know you spend a lot of time looking at the night sky. We're going to talk about a couple other presentations coming up, the stars and the aurora. They're beautiful. What else draws you to that, Steve?
Well, it's being outdoors, and also darkness for a lot of people is something not comfortable with. And if you learn the constellations and learn what's happening in the night sky, then you feel more comfortable when you're out at night.
Okay. All right. And the other presentations coming up, so again, that's tonight at 6:30 is the Aurora, the presentation on the Aurora, the Northern Lights. And then, let's see, the next one is Tuesday, March 21st, right?
Right, which is the equinox, beginning of spring.
All right, and what can we expect that night?
Well, in equinox, we're going to talk about a road trip that my wife and I recently did to Mount Kailash in far western Tibet. And it's probably the most sacred pilgrimage in the world. People have been going there to hike around the mountain, Mount Kailash, for thousands of years. It's mentioned in some of the oldest sacred writings of South Asia, the Mahabharata, the Bhagavad Gita, and the Upanishads.
Okay, so that's on Tuesday, March 21st at what time?
7 p.m.
7 p.m.
That's a free presentation.
And what can people expect there?
Well, we're going to talk about the logistics about getting to Tibet, because that changes all the time. You do have to submit some paperwork to get into Tibet. And we're going to talk about our own experience getting there and how we had to prepare, because the trek, we spent 4 days hiking around the mountain, and the highest pass was almost 19,000 feet.
Wow.
So we'll talk a little bit about acclimating at elevations.
And what do the stars look like from that high?
Well, actually, I've been to most of the dark sky sites in the world, southern Utah, southern New Zealand, in the middle of the ocean, Pacific Ocean, Indian Ocean, and the night sky I saw up at elevation in the Himalayas, it's the best night skies I've seen.
Okay. And then, if you want to learn how to photograph all of everything we're talking about, you can go to a night sky photography workshop on the 25th, just the end of that week. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we've had Dennis Mamana, who is an astronomer from San Diego. He's been coming every year to Juneau for about the last 5 years. And he's going to do two shows in March. On March 24th, he's going to do a show on the total solar eclipse. It's the first total solar eclipse to cross mainland USA since 1979, August 20th this year. It'll be total from Oregon to Virginia. He's going to talk about that March 24th at 7 p.m. And March 25th at 7 p.m., he's going to talk about the Big Dipper, and which is, of course, on our state flag. And during the day on March 25th, he's going to give a night sky photography workshop, which he has done before. And this will all be in the planetarium.
Excellent. I hope you'll come back and remind us
about these. And we'll have Dennis here to be interviewed.
Speaking of night sky photography, tonight, you mentioned some of the photographies you'll be showing images of?
Yeah, we'll be showing images that I've collected from the Internet, not photos I've taken, but images from the Internet of the Northern Lights, the Aurora Borealis, the Aurora Australis, the Polar Lights, the Aurora.
Okay. If people want more information, Steve, on the planetarium and all these great events, where can they get that?
Well, the planetarium has a website, mariedrakeplanetarium.org. Marie Drake Planetarium is all one word, and we keep it updated, and we have a sign-up sheet on that so people can get email on our upcoming events.
All right. Steve, sounds good. You can meet Steve and learn more about the Aurora, the Northern Lights, tonight at 6:30 at the Marie Drake Planetarium. Admission is free. Again, it's at 6:30 right over there between Harborview Elementary and JDHS by the turf field.
Right, yeah, exactly. Artificial turf field. Sure.
Great, Steve. Sounds good. Anything else you want to add?
I think that covers it. Thank you so much, Scott.
You're welcome.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday, the 27th of February, 2017. The birthday of the novelist John Steinbeck, Salinas, California, 1902. His most productive decade was the 1930s. He wrote the novel Tortilla Flat, set in Monterey, California, in dubious battle about fruit pickers on strike in a California valley, of mice and men, set on a ranch in Soledad, just southeast of Salinas, the story of the farm worker Lenny and his friend George, which was a big success and also a book which has been banned in many places. And then Grapes of Wrath came out in 1940, after which Steinbeck worked as a journalist in the 1940s, first as a war correspondent from the Mediterranean and North Africa in World War II. And after the war, he took trips to the Soviet Union, to Moscow, Kiev, Stalingrad, and out-of-the-way places in the Soviet Union, tried learning Russian, published his notes in 1948 in a book, A Russian Journal. East of Eden came out in 1952, and then Travels with Charlie, 1962. And in the same year, John Steinbeck won the Nobel Prize for Literature. When a reporter at a press conference asked if he thought he deserved it, he said, frankly, no. And afterwards, Steinbeck was worried about the effect of the Nobel Prize on him as a writer. He said, I don't remember anyone doing any work after receiving the prize, except maybe George Bernard Shaw. The Nobel Prize has, in effect, amounted to an epitaph. And as it happened, John Steinbeck died 6 years later, not having published a book after winning the Nobel Prize. His masterpiece, The Grapes of Wrath, in which he wrote, the cars of the migrant people crawled out of the side roads onto the great cross-country highway, and they took the migrant way to the west. And because they were lonely and perplexed, because they had all come from a place of sadness and worry and defeat, and because they were all going to a mysterious new place, a strange thing happened. The 20 families became one family. The children were the children of all. The loss of home became one loss, and the golden time in the West was one dream. John Steinbeck, who said, the writer must believe that what he is doing is the most important thing in the world, and he must hold to this illusion even when he knows it is not true. Here's a poem by William Blake, The Tiger. Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night, what immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry? In what distant deeps or skies burnt the fire of thine eyes? On what wings dare he aspire? What the hand dare seize the fire? And what shoulder and what art could twist the sinews of thy heart? And when thy heart began to beat, what dread hand and what dread feet? What the hammer, what the chain, in what furnace was thy brain? What the anvil, what dread grasp dare its deadly terrors clasp? When the stars threw down their spears and watered heaven with their tears, did he smile his work to see? Did he who made the lamb make thee? Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night, what immortal hand or eye dare frame thy fearful symmetry? The Tiger by William Blake. That's the Writer's Almanac, supported by Progressive, offering policyholders the option to bundle home and auto insurance coverage. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
You're listening to Juno Afternoon here on Monday, February 27th, about 20 minutes until the top of the hour. And joining me in the studio right now is musician Annie Bartholomew. Welcome to the show, Annie.
Thanks, Scott.
Yeah, nice to have you here. So we're here to talk about your first Friday concert at Kindred Post, among other things. That's this Friday, huh?
It is. I'm getting so excited.
What kind of stuff can we expect on Friday? What are you going to be playing?
It'll be a lot of traditionals, jazz standards, some of my original work, but really playing the music. I just got done performing in Kansas City at the Folk Alliance Conference, so I thought I'd come back to town and share some of that while it's still fresh in my mind and in my hands.
How would you describe to our listeners the kind of music you play?
You know, it's like a darker blues. I first learned how to play guitar at bluegrass camp when I was a teenager, and my vocal range didn't fit into that, like, beautiful melodic folk singing voice. I always wanted it, but then I found later that, oh, my voice is perfect for, you know, these Bessie Smith tunes. And over the past 2 months, I've been reimagining these 1920s piano tunes for guitar, which is tough because once you simplify down those amazing standards, they're a little bit simpler, but that's where you get into the fun with guitar picking and stuff like that. So there to share.
The darker blues.
Yeah, I mean, I just feel like there's just so much complexity and struggle in the blues, and why not celebrate it? I mean, some of it's happy, but some of it is really dark, which I love. I mean, St. James Infirmary blues, even like spirituals like Wayfaring Stranger, you can churn them up and make them sound different. I mean, there's plenty of happy music out there. I like happy music. But I also like to take music to places that, you know, a lot of us live.
Buddy Tabor would be very proud of you right now if he was here.
That's such a compliment. Oh, my gosh.
He heard me playing a really sad song and came out, and he didn't really hug, but he gave me, like, high five or shook my hand. He's like, man, I really love sad songs, too. Thank you.
But it won't be a bummer, you know?
No, not at all. You mentioned Folk Alliance. Tell us, you just recently got back from, was it Kansas City?
Yeah, Kansas City, Missouri. There are two Kansas cities. One is in Kansas. I was like, my mind was blown by how connected everything in the Midwest is. You can just like get on a train and go to Memphis. It's crazy. So I went there with a bunch of musicians based out of Anchorage and Portland. And we were there to kind of represent Alaska and kind of see what the landscape's like for folk music right now, and it was a really productive trip. I mean, folk music is alive and well, and the message was kind of like, you're living tradition, so go out there and practice it, and really study these old songs and old styles, and don't forget them, but help bring them into this decade and present them to this generation. So it's kind of like South by Southwest Music Festival, but it's all based in a hotel with these showcase rooms, and you're just seeing so many talented, amazing musicians in all different kinds and styles. There are a lot of people from Canada, folks from Australia, folks from the UK sharing what they do.
And as opposed to South By, you said that this one was very sort of accessible and supportive.
Yeah. I mean, everybody was so positive. And I've been to South By Southwest. I usually go every couple years. And it's really exciting because you're seeing new music and it's very image-driven. But the people you meet can't always help you. You know, they might work for a big publicity firm and they don't even care about your music. They're there for the big acts. And here it was kind of all of these producers and people who really want to take you on as a client and help bring out the best in your sound. And there were lots of musicians to collaborate with. So I really felt like I'm meeting lots of movers and shakers who are doing this stuff in other states who really want to come to Juneau and figure out how we do things here.
Cool. And you even talked about maybe doing a workshop here in Juneau in the near future, right?
Yeah, with the Alaska Independent Musicians Initiative, which was the group that I went to Kansas City with. We want to do a workshop. It's going to be in March before the Juneau Arts and Humanities Council grants are due to kind of get people ready for Folk Fest. So it's for people who may have never performed on stage or may be like me performing on stage for years. But there's things you can learn, like mic placement, like what kind of cables you should bring with you, how to get the most out of working with a sound person. And Alaska Music One is going to be helping us come up with curriculum so that when you're on stage, you get the most out of that performance, and the audience does as well.
Excellent. Let us know when you get the date for that.
I will.
That sounds very useful. So this first Friday, like in a couple of days, you're going to be at the Tiny Post Office. What time does that start?
That's at 4:30 to 7-ish.
All right. And are those free? I can't remember. Or is there a cost for those?
Oh, no. It's just like first Friday. So it's like shopping with a soundtrack. I'll just be there with my guitar playing quietly, Okay. Accompanying everyone.
And this is a preview for another concert, right?
Yeah. On Friday the 24th, I'm going to be doing a Tiny Post Office concert with Jacob Picard. And it'll be my first kind of CD release. I'm doing a small EP of songs I played in Kansas City, and I'm only making 50 of them.
Wow. Limited release.
Oh, yeah.
Excellent. Well, that sounds great, Annie. In the meantime, so that's March 24th, but in the meantime, this first Friday at Kindred Post, and again, songs from Bessie Smith, possibly. Who else?
Ma Rainey, you know, traditionals, might do some Janis. I don't know. I can go there. I got a lot of time to fill. It's like 2.5 hours.
And why Kindred Post?
That place is just magical. And it's one of those places in Juneau where people can really sit down and listen to you. And I don't expect people to sit down this Friday. It's going to be more about the atmosphere and creating a place where people can shop and enjoy a little music.
Annie, thank you so much for coming on the show. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
The recording that I'm putting out the 24th is possible from a grant from the Juneau Arts and Humanities Council. So thank you to them. And April 1st is the deadline.
All right. We'll see you this Friday at Kinder Post.
Thanks.
Listening to a Juneau Afternoon here on Monday, February 27th, about 11 minutes until the top of the hour. And joining me in the studio now is Mark Wilcox. He's a Coast Guard officer, but he's also been working on the Backcountry Film Festival for this year that benefits the Southeast Alaska Avalanche Center. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you.
Yeah, nice to have you. So the Backcountry Film Festival, what are some of the films that we can expect this year? What are they like?
Well, usually the films that Winter Wildlands puts together are a combination of some of the staple, you know, ski movies that are out for the season, but then they also try to find some local or regional ones. So, for instance, this year there's one about women guides in Alaska. So that's always pretty nice to have that local touch, and there'll usually be some on snow safety. But then there'll be the usual, like, larger production company segments that, you know, everyone's kind of familiar with. But they all focus on human-powered backcountry travel, usually skiing or snowboarding, splitboarding.
And was I correct to say that these both screenings, it looks like there's one on March 2nd and one on March 10th?
That's right.
And both of them support the Southeast Alaska Avalanche Center?
Correct. And the Juneau Mountain Rescue and a little bit the Alpine Club. So the first one will be our big event this coming Thursday, and then the goal town will be to make sure that all of you that couldn't make it on Thursday can make it out.
Got it. So, again, the second, March 2nd at 7 p.m. at the Rockwell?
Correct.
And that's, let's see, today's 27, 28. That's Thursday, did you say?
Correct.
All right. So this Thursday at the Rockwell at 7, and then on the 10th at the Gold Town, is that right?
Correct.
What day of the week is that?
That's a Saturday evening, so kind of a mid-evening showing.
I know you've probably put a lot of work into getting this all together, Mark. Why do you get behind the Southeast Alaska Avalanche Center and Juneau Mountain Rescue?
Well, we're just trying to, you know, in keeping with the theme, try to benefit some local charities that are doing work to kind of to keep people safe in the backcountry. And Juneau in particular, you know, we aren't connected to the road system like a lot of other places. We don't have a lot of those outside resources. So getting giving support to these small hometown organizations that are supporting us, keeping us safe, is pretty important.
Okay. If people want more information on when these films are going to screen or who's supporting them or door prizes, things like that, where can they go?
There is a Facebook site, and you should be able to just search for Backcountry Film Festival 2017 Juneau, and you'll find out all the various sponsors. We have a lot of local vendors that have given us door prizes, and they're all listed there.
All right. Again, that's this Thursday at the Rockwell at 7, and then on the 10th, a Saturday, at the Gold Town Nickelodeon at 9 p.m. Mark, thanks for coming onto the show. What's admission to these?
We're asking for a suggested donation of $10, so and then we'll be selling some raffle tickets to earn some extra money. Last year we had over 200 people, so it's a good time. You can ask them.
Excellent, Mark. Thanks for coming on the show. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, appreciate it, and it looks like we're having a much better season than last year, so hopefully everybody's motivated to come out and celebrate.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks.
This is Bird Note. Even in the ruthless grip of winter, when the snow crunches beneath your boots, an ember glows in the lilt of a black-capped chickadee. Even in the northern states, where the Arctic can seem too close for comfort, springtime erupts from the song of a house finch. Even now in February, when the air outside is brittle and painful, warmth rides the rhythm of an American robin. No, spring isn't just around the corner, at least not in the north. But even in winter, some birds greet the sunrise with song. We normally hear the dawn chorus in springtime, when birds sing to define territory and attract mates. But birds don't breed by warmth alone. Day length is a far more reliable spark than weather. And in February, as the days grow longer, birds begin to sing a prelude to spring. It's not entirely clear how they measure day length, but we do know that photoreceptors in birds' brains sense the increasing light. It triggers the production of hormones, which helps bring on the breeding season. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Programming support comes from listeners like you and GCI, providing internet, phone, and television services throughout the state. GCI, serving Alaska since 1979.
Hi, this is Paula Terrell from the Year of Kindness Steering Committee. I'm here to encourage you to take part in Juneau's community-wide 17YOK initiative by doing one kind act each day and once a week directing a kind act towards someone outside your normal circle. You can get more information on the Year of Kindness by visiting the Juneau Police Department's Facebook page. Together, we can make Juneau a better place to live.
You're listening to a Juneau Afternoon here on Monday, February 27th, about 5 minutes until the top of the hour. And joining me in the studio now is Amy O'Neill Hauk and also Katie Bosler. They are on the board of the statewide writing group 49 Writers. Welcome to the show, Amy and Katie.
Thank you.
It's nice
good to be
have
here,
you
Scott.
Both here. Amy, if somebody doesn't know what 49 Writers is, how would you describe it?
I would say it's an organization for writers and lovers of literature. So we support and promote writing and literature in the 49 states. So that's where the 49 comes in.
Okay. Workshops, groups,
classes, events, literary events. We coordinate with, people around the state. And Juneau is a town filled with amazing writers, so there's a lot of opportunity, including quite a few that are coming up in the next week or so.
Yeah, probably the biggest one is this Brian Kastner.
Right, yeah, he's an Iraq veteran, and he's written a lot about war and crisis, and he's going to be doing a nonfiction workshop, an all-day workshop on the 11th of March at the SLAM. And this is going to be kind of a cool opportunity to work with this nonfiction writer. And he also wrote a book bestseller called All the Ways We Kill and Die. So the workshop is going to take place from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the SLAM classroom. And Brian will be here on a Juneau afternoon, I think on the 10th of March, because that night he's also giving a free talk at the Mendenhall Hall.
Mendenhall Library
in the Valley. But we just want to let people know about this to start thinking about it. And if you want to, get more information about it or sign up, you can go to the 49 Writers website.
Which is 49writers.org.
Okay, there you go. Yeah, and it has all the info there. And also there's an email if you want to get more information. It's info@49writers.org. And also, if you are a veteran or an active duty member of any military or National Guard branch, you can register as a member of 49 Writers, and there's a discount there, and there's also scholarships. So again, info@49writers.org if you want to get information about the scholarship opportunity.
You are both writers, especially of creative nonfiction. This is going to be a nonfiction workshop. What is something one might learn at a workshop like this?
Well, I think one of the things that we've found is that in telling true stories, you can inhabit a world fully, and you can use tools that fiction writers use to create something that's just as engaging and exciting and captivating as any kind of work of fiction.
Yeah, I think that's the main thing because, your own true story can be really interesting to you and maybe your family members, your next-door neighbor, but to make it engaging and interesting to someone who doesn't know anything about you or where you're coming from, you kind of need this crafting. It's a craft, writing, right? And so this is an expert at this nonfiction craft who's coming to town, who's giving this all-day workshop, and we think it's a great opportunity.
Sounds like it. We have only 30 seconds left. I'm sorry, you two. Can you give us the details again and where people can learn more?
So 49writers.org, that's the main place to go. And if you want to email, it's info@49writers.org.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to add, Katie?
Well, just real quick, March 6th, mark your calendar, Julie LeMay, is going to be here, and she'll be doing a reading with Jeremy Pataki, who's the director of 49 Writers, and that'll be at the Jack Gallery at 6:30.
All right. Thanks for coming on the show, you two.
Thank you.